My guest today is Jacob Bell. Jacob is headed to grad school in the fall to study metaphysics and philosophy of mind. He's written articles on ancient philosophy for Classical Wisdom Weekly, and he has a popular Facebook page called Philosophy Daily. We discuss what's becoming the norm for this podcast, consciousness. We spend a lot of time on neutral monism and structural realism, or as it's sometimes called, relational metaphysics. We also touch upon emergence, intrinsic natures, causation, and the relevance of the Aristotelian notion of potentiality and actuality. I didn't know much about structural realism going in. I learned a lot from Jacob. And just to give everyone a working definition of a couple key terms that get thrown around, by intrinsic nature, I mean nature that's non-relational, that can't be fully captured quantitatively. Structural realism is the view that scientific theories tell us only about the form or structure of the unobservable world, and not about its nature. So this leaves open the question as to whether the natures of things are simply unknowable, or should be eliminated from our ontology altogether. Structural realism is an aggressively austere form of metaphysics, wherein only structure and relation are real. Everything else in metaphysics should be consigned to the flames. It's been a widely discussed view, and most seem to find the more radical forms implausible, with most, including Jacob, defending a more moderate form. Near the end, it starts raining pretty hard and it picks up on Mike, but that shouldn't be too distracting. I had a good time talking to Jacob, so without further ado, let's get to my conversation with Jacob Bell. So, Jacob Bell, thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So, we're here to talk about neutral monism, which is associated with great thinkers such as Spinoza, William James, and Bertrand Russell. So what is neutral monism?
It's kind of hard to define as a whole. There are a lot of different positions within the neutral monist camp.
Right, it's a big tent.
It is. I would say fundamentally neutral monism would be something like the position that the fundamental reality is some type of neutral stuff. I say stuff here because it could be an event particular. It could be some type of substance. There are a lot of different options there. And then once we get into the neutral aspect of it, there's, again, a bunch of different positions on that. I tend to take the neither view, so it's neither physical nor mental. And, you know, it's interesting because I was really led into neutral monism through the studying that I was doing on relational metaphysics, or I think it's more popularly referred to as structural realism. And once we get into my position on neutral monism, it might be a little easier to describe my position if I talk about the relational metaphysics first.
Okay, so you weren't led to neutral monism by thinking about consciousness exactly, or like problems related to, you know, like the mind-body problem or something like that?
I was not, actually. It definitely has applications there, and I'm working through those at the moment. But yeah, I kind of just happened upon it naturally through studying something else, which is kind of interesting. I first came into contact with neutral monism some years ago, and I thought it was interesting, but I didn't really think too much more about it until pretty recently.
Yeah, it seems to kind of be the cool kid's position these days. Like, it kind of seems to be, like, if you know enough not to be a physicalist, but you also don't want to be a dualist, then it seems like the position is neutral monism. That is that your perception as well, that it seems to be kind of the most popular view at the moment among, like, philosophers?
I wouldn't argue against that. It's definitely gained a lot of popularity lately, and it's just kind of cool to see all the different positions, all the different routes you can take it. You can do a lot with the theory, with the basic idea, and I think as we move more toward this idea that physicalism, traditionally understood, or materialism, isn't really the answer, I think it might become even more popular.
So I'm curious about how all this relates to structural realism, because like I said, I primarily think about neutral monism in the context of philosophy of mind, but you were led to it via a different path. But first, how interested are you in, I mean, like, are you bothered by problems with consciousness, or does that not really keep you up at night?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking about it, so I think it definitely has kept me up at night. But I, you know, I started to distance myself from those questions for a little while, or tried to, just so I could pursue something else, because, you know, you hit a lot of dead ends, it seems. And, so I wanted to pursue, my interest in ontic, structural realism or relational metaphysics, kind of the same thing. They're interchangeable titles there. And then, you know, leading into neutral monism, and now I'm just starting to explore where that's going to take me as far as consciousness goes.
So, like I said, I'm curious about how this relates to structural realism. So what is structural realism, and how similar is it to your own view?
There are two different, at least as far as I know, there are really two different camps of structural realism. And it's kind of a minority view in contemporary philosophy. So radical or eliminative structural realism would claim that there are no basic individual things, but that there are really only relational entities and properties. But the problem with this that a lot of people pointed out is that in order for relations or structures to exist, doesn't something need to stand in relation? And this kind of takes us to the next view, which is considered moderate relational metaphysics or moderate structural realism. And they attempt to answer that criticism by admitting what they would refer to as relata. Relata is just a term that describes whatever it is that stands in relation, that allows those structures to be created. So the relata instantiate the relations, if that makes sense.
I'm not sure I get that. Is that... It sounds like you're still just saying there's nothing but relation.
Instead, if we're not using it, it's to use a different term, because relata would just describe a thing standing in relation. It might be good to refer to Michael S. Felt's position on this. He's considered a moderate structural realist. He takes the idea that physical objects exist, and they're what stands in relation. They're not the relations themselves, but they instantiate it. And so that's his view. And he also takes the problem of intrinsic properties pretty seriously. And he even goes as far as to claim that not only are there no intrinsic properties that we can know of, but that they don't exist. So on his view, there are these physical objects that have no properties, but they stand in relation, and that's what gives rise to these structures or these relations.
So is moderate structural realism compatible with intrinsic natures, or do all forms of structural realism just get rid of the notion of intrinsic natures?
I know the more moderate position gets rid of it. I mean, I would imagine the radical view does as well. Simply because if all that exists are relations, then I'm not sure if what you would even refer to as an intrinsic nature on that view. I guess there could be an argument in the moderate view that there could be some type of intrinsic nature, but it seems like most structural realist positions are kind of inspired by epistemic structural realism, and that was kind of the position that all we can know about the natural world are the relational or structural properties. And so ontic structural realism, when we're talking about ontology or metaphysics here, just kind of takes that idea laid out from a epistemic structural realism and just applies it to things. So there's, you know, the radical version is just saying that there are no things. And if all we can know about the natural world or relational structural properties, then maybe that's all that exists.
Right. So there's the more moderate view that's kind of an epistemic structural realism that says all we can know is structure in the sense of relation. You know, that's all we have access to, like through science, for example. But ontic structural realism is saying that there actually is nothing but structure and relation. It's not that there's some intrinsic nature or something that is there, but we don't have access to. There's literally nothing but, you know, because science tells us about relation. So basically, there's just what science tells us, but there's no additional kind of metaphysical interpretation of what's going on there?
I think any structural realist position is metaphysical by nature. So I wouldn't say that there's not a metaphysical interpretation, but they're definitely, for the most part, saying that there are no intrinsic natures to be discovered. That's Esfeld's more moderate position, and then I think it just kind of follows from the more radical position that that's the conclusion that they would come to as well, if all that exists are relations or structures.
It's like the most austere metaphysics you could possibly have.
Yes. And Esfeld's papers on this, when he's talking about intrinsic properties, not only being unknowable but not existing at all, he makes a claim that he's cohering epistemology and metaphysics by doing so. Because if there's something that exists but we can't know it, there's kind of an incoherence between our epistemology and our metaphysics there. And he also makes a claim that that makes his position a little more parsimonious. I'm sympathetic to the to that argument. I'm sympathetic to the idea that it's possible that there could be no intrinsic natures, because I'm unsure how we would get at it, especially considering that if we take the idea that we haven't discovered any intrinsic natures at this point, not to say that we couldn't do so in the future, but if we haven't already, might not be an unreasonable thing to start to think.
Right, and this is why you can't really separate some of this from philosophy of mind. David Chalmers and William Seeger and like other philosophers of mind have pointed out that we seem to know about intrinsic natures directly. Like, we seem to have direct access to intrinsic non-relational properties, namely phenomenal properties. So isn't ontic structural realism sort of similar to eliminativism and eliminative materialism?
It definitely could be. I think the more radical versions are kind of similar to that. Like maybe something like the ontic structural realism that's outlined in the book Everything Must Go by James Ladyman and Don Ross. That's kind of the more popular version of this position, for lack of a better term. But as far as intrinsic properties being known, internally or something, I'm always curious when, the likes of Philip Goff claim that we know that that's an intrinsic property, because it almost seems like he's using the word intrinsic in two different ways when he goes from talking about what an intrinsic property is. It's something that something has in and of itself. An intrinsic property would be something that an object would have without regard to accompaniment or loneliness of anything else. And then it seems like that's kind of how he starts to define intrinsic properties. But then he goes on to claim that we know consciousness or phenomenal experience as an intrinsic property to matter, but then it seems at that point he's using it more as an internal to denote something internal rather than something that is a property of something in and of itself.
Yeah, I don't see the incompatibility there. Like, I think that he's kind of trying to hit two birds with one stone, where we have these conscious states that aren't intersubjectively available. Like he would say consciousness is unobservable. So he's in a way kind of endorsing epistemic structural realism, even though he would say it's Russellian monism. But the thing is, those two sound pretty similar to me, so I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that Russellian monism, which is just the idea that science can tell us about relation and structure and behavior, but it can't tell us about intrinsic natures if there is an intrinsic nature to be discovered. So if consciousness was a relational property, then why wouldn't it be observable? Because we can observe all other relational properties.
I think this is where it would be worthwhile to appeal to how neutral monism fits into a relational picture, simply because, on my view, the fundamental nature of reality is neutral. And so
As in not physical and not mental.
Not physical and not mental, and not a middle weight either. So neutrality here is really signaling a complete lack of allegiance. I know some positions want to claim that neutral monism exists in this middle way in between physical and mental. But I want to say that it just has no allegiance to the physical, mental, or middle way whatsoever. And the reason why I would say that the picture that I have of structural realism is neutral is I kind of take Esfeld's position until he starts to talk about these things that instantiate relations as physical objects, because, you know, Esfeld takes the problem of intrinsic nature seriously, and even talks about how the physical objects that stand in relation are propertyless. They don't have any properties of their own. If that's the case, I'm really unsure how you could call that a physical object, because by calling something physical, you're giving it some type of nature. You're characterizing it as something. So it couldn't just be this neutral thing, or this propertyless thing. Which he doesn't use neutral monism here. That's why he calls it a physical object. But he does say that it has no intrinsic nature or no properties in and of itself. And so that's where my neutral monism comes into the picture on the relational metaphysics view. And, you know, I could talk us through the position, my position a little bit more, but the conclusion really is just that fundamentally nothing's physical or mental. And even at the manifest level of observable world, there isn't anything inherently physical or mental either.
Can you walk me through some of that again? I'm not sure I caught all of it.
Yeah. So Esfeld describes his relata, so the stuff that's standing in relation, that's instantiating relations. Instead of being characterized by intrinsic properties, all there is to the basic physical objects are the relations in which they stand. According to this position, neither objects nor relations have an ontological priority with respect to the physical world. They're both on the same footing, belonging both to the ontological ground floor. So there's an interdependence here between the relations and the relata. Like one can't be said to exist without the other. They're concurrent in that sense. And so he's claiming that the world is physical and the things which stand in relation are physical objects. And I think that this is at odds with the idea that no intrinsic nature or properties can be known and that they do not exist. I think it just is kind of a logical contradiction there.
Because he's saying they're physical?
Yeah, because he's claiming that they're physical objects, but he's also saying in one and the same paper that they don't have any properties of themselves, that they're propertyless. All they're doing is standing in relation and enabling the relations to manifest themselves, if that makes sense.
Right. He's saying that they have no properties, but they're physical, so they must have physical properties.
Yeah, I would say if you're going to call something physical, even if you're not explicitly doing it, you're implicitly giving them some type of characteristic or nature.
I do have a hard time wrapping my mind around structural realism for a couple of reasons. Well, I guess I have two not really arguments, but reasons that I personally doubt the stronger forms of structural realism. And we can take them one at a time, but let me just put them both on the table up front. The first reason is that I'm drawn to the idea that there has to be an intrinsic ground of these relations. If there isn't an intrinsic ground, then there seems to be this sort of vicious circularity, if you know what I mean. It takes a long time to go around the circle, but it still kind of feels circular. They never seem to terminate anywhere. They don't seem to be grounded in anything. And it seems like there has to be something that has an intrinsic nature, if for nothing else, just to grant meaning to, you know, our language. And the second, if we bracket that concern and just say, or ask, is structural realism coherent? And the answer could be yes, you know, it could be coherent. There could be a possible world where ontic structural realism is true, but that's not our world because we know about consciousness directly. And I'm deeply skeptical of the idea that we could account for experience with nothing but relation without simply eliminating experience. But we know consciousness is real. It's a datum that needs explaining. And that's typically called revelation. It's what you were alluding to with Goff earlier. So I accept revelation that we're directly aware of phenomenal consciousness, which seems to fit the bill for something that has an intrinsic nature. So, you know, we're a part of the physical world, you're a physical system, and you have direct access to these non-relational properties, which, like I said earlier, I think if they were relational, they would be observable, but they're not. So the first concern is basically like vicious circularity. So let's tackle that one first.
It's definitely a concern to not have a grounding, to not have an intrinsic nature to point to. But I just don't find the arguments for some type of mentality or consciousness as an intrinsic property of the physical world at large, down to the smallest particle. I just don't find that a convincing argument. And so there doesn't seem to be anywhere else to go with the problem of intrinsic natures at this point, as far as I've discovered. And so since I'm not convinced by that argument, I'm really just led into this position.
Oh, I see. So you're saying the only potential intrinsic natures we're aware of are phenomenal, but you don't think that it's very plausible to think that everything has an intrinsic nature that's phenomenal. So you're led to structural realism, because what other intrinsic nature would there be?
Yeah, I'm definitely more sympathetic to the view for that reason.
Well, I agree with you, but I just kind of bite the panpsychist bullet there.
Right, right.
Like, what intrinsic natures would there be other than the ones that we're directly familiar? We only know about one of them. Why would you postulate another one?
Right. You know, and that's where we would differ, in that I wouldn't consider mentality or phenomenal experience as an intrinsic nature. I would have to accept the argument in order to take that position. And then if I did, then yeah, why would you look for another one if that's what if you're convinced of that?
So talk a little bit more about that, about consciousness as a series of relations, how would you characterize it in structural realist language? How would you talk about something like experience?
Yeah, I think it would be good to appeal to Ernest Mach at this point. He was not a structural realist, but he was a neutral monist. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his work on neutral monism, but he appeals to, I think he refers to them as functional relations or a functional dependence. So he uses some relational wording here, but I don't think he ever took up a structural realist position. So Mach says, the great gulf between physical and psychological research persists only when we acquiesce in our habitual stereotyped conceptions. A color is a physical object as soon as we consider its dependence, for instance, upon its luminous source, upon the colors, upon temperatures, upon spaces, and so forth. When we consider, however, its dependence upon the retina, it is a psychological object, a sensation. Not the subject matter, but the direction of investigation is different in the two domains. It is only in their functional dependence that the elements are sensations. In another functional relation, they're at the same time physical objects. And so for Mach, a particular element, he used event, I think he used verbiage like event particular or elements when he was talking about these neutral things. That's what was the neutral monism of him. So like for Mach, a particular element such as the color red is neutral in the sense that it doesn't have an inherent definite or strict ontology of being either mental or physical, but it's a neutral particular that really only seems physical in one sense when you're relating it in a certain way, and it seems physical in another sense when it's being related in another way. And so for him, I mean, that's a pretty vivid description that he gives of an experience that is neutral.
It doesn't sound neutral to me. It sounds physical to me when he's talking about the retina. And if you were to bring it into the modern day, he could talk about, you know, brain states and things like that. Those to me just sound like physical states, which leave out kind of the essentially mental part of experience, which is, you know, what makes the mind-body problem interesting and the hard problem hard.
As far as leaving out the phenomenal aspect of that as far as the leaving out like what it's like to see red, for example.
Yeah, which is why it seems like structural realism would lead to just denying the reality of phenomenal consciousness.
Right. I would say the more stronger versions of it might do that. I'm not really sure what the implications of the radical versions entail, just because I'm not very sympathetic to those views. But Mach definitely was not a structural realist. He was just a neutral monist. And that's kind of how he was describing experience. At that point, it's just dependent upon relations. I mean, if we take an analogy and we use Gestalt psychology, I'm sure you're aware of the Gestalt image of the duck rabbit, which at first glance you either see a duck or a rabbit. Are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So oftentimes people can't really see the picture as the other animal until it's pointed out to them. They just kind of see this first thing until they're told otherwise or read otherwise. But once it's pointed out, it's pretty easy for them to switch back and forth between seeing it as a rabbit or as a duck. But the analogy here would be an appeal to our habitual behaviors as far as categorizing something or the other as either physical or mental. And we could take, for an ordinary example, a brown wooden chair. I mean, when one is focused on the qualitative aspects of the chair's color, and they're just kind of deep in that qualitative experience, it seems like a mental or phenomenal event. When one touches the chair, it's another type of phenomenal experience. It's how the chair feels. But at one and the same time, one could easily, almost instantly switch to viewing the chair as a physical object. One could begin to investigate the color brown in terms of photons, electromagnetic radiation, reflection, etc. Or one could think about what the wood is made up of, namely a cellular structure composed of cellulose, hemicellulose, lignin. And in a sense, then, I would argue that the perceived distinction of the physical and mental is an illusion perpetuated by how something is being related, and that in and of itself, it really isn't mental or physical. It's just designated as such according to how it's being related at the time.
Right. So the reality is the duck rabbit, and we look at it one way, and it's the physical, and we look at it the other way, and it's the mental, but there's really just this one neutral, and you didn't want to say substance, right?
Right. I don't want to say substance. You know, when I'm talking about, if we're talking about manifest reality, you know, the observable things in the world, I'm not sure I would be against saying substance, but when I'm talking about the neutral monism aspect, like these things that are instantiating the relation, I don't want to use the word substance. And I can kind of explain why if you want to get to that. But before we leave off this analogy here, I was listening to your conversation with Aaron recently on Strong Emergence, and it sounded like you were starting to talk about something similar when you're talking about dual aspect theory. Do you have anything to comment on what I was just talking about in that regard?
I was actually trying not to bring up dual aspect monism because I thought I'd be changing the subject too strongly. But yeah, what you were just saying there reminded me a lot of dual aspect monism. I didn't want to derail what you were thinking about. But yeah, no, I was definitely, a dual aspect picture was forming in my mind as you were talking.
Yeah. As soon as I heard that on that conversation, I was like, yeah, that's dead. I could definitely see how that would be related. And I think, you know, I would take that route if I weren't committed to the idea that fundamental reality is neutral.
Yeah, it's unclear if dual aspect monism is a form of neutral monism. Like, some people say it is and some people say it's not. It kind of depends on the details. I don't think it is, personally, at least not my form. I think that maybe you start off as a neutral monist and then you try to fill in some of the details, and then you kind of end up like a degree or two away from neutral monism. So like, some people consider dual aspect monism a form of neutral monism, but the thing is, you're not really being neutral anymore. Like, there's no more neutrality in the substance or process or whatever if you're saying that it's both mental and physical. You're not saying it's neither mental or physical. You're saying it's both mental and physical.
Right. You know, and I have seen some neutral monist positions that claim that it's both. And again, that just harkens back to the beginning of our conversation about all the different positions you can take from neutral monism. And if that falls into it, that's a lot different than saying the neither view, but maybe it's still considered neutral monism.
I'm not very sympathetic to the neither view for a few reasons, because it seems to not solve one of the main issues that I had with physicalism. There are advantages to neutral monism. Like, it's definitely the most plausible, socially acceptable position to take right now, you know, among like physicalism, dualism, and neutral monism, which at least to my mind, they seem to dominate public opinion right now. But the thing is, like, if you're going to say that it's neutral, then it seems to me that you're saying that it's essentially non-mental. So you're still stuck with the hard problem. Like, you're still going to be stuck with some form of strong emergence, I would argue. It's not obviously true, but I'm saying once you dig into it, then you'll be stuck with strong emergence anyway. So, you know, you still have other advantages as a neutral monist. Like, it solves certain problems of dualism while giving mentality its due for the most part, but you're still stuck with this, what I think is kind of a brute emergence that doesn't really distinguish it much from physicalism, because you're saying fundamental reality is whatever it is, it's essentially non-mental, and you still have experience emerging from non-experience, which to me violates some kind of conservation intuition, like some kind of you can't get something from nothing type of intuition.
Right. I'm definitely sympathetic to that idea. And I've thought about the emergence issue a lot lately with regards to neutral monism. I mean, I want to say it's weak emergence, because it's not, I mean, if it's, okay, it's non-mental, it's essentially non-mental, but it's also essentially non-physical, and we're getting these physical properties now. I know you would say that, okay, so we're getting two strong emergent problems here. I'm definitely not comfortable characterizing it as strong emergence. As far as our empirical data goes, it kind of seems like something like an emergence of experience would have to be the case, unless, of course, we take the panpsychist position. Which, you know, one of the reasons that I'm just not comfortable with the argument of intrinsic property, of mentality being an intrinsic property of matter at large, you know, down to the smallest particle, is because it seems like this is the way the argument goes, and correct me if I'm wrong. We have matter, and the only thing we know, I'm just going to use intrinsic here, even though this isn't my position. The only thing we know intrinsically about it is that some of it's conscious. And from there, I think it's a really big leap to say that because we know complex biological organisms have consciousness, and so this bit of matter does have consciousness, I think it's a big leap to extrapolate that outward to everything. It just seems like if all we really know is that complex biological organisms have some type of consciousness, and by complex, I mean, we can even talk about an insect, and maybe there is something like that, it's like to be the insect, but that would even be a complex biological organism under that definition. And so to extrapolate that out to the smallest particle just seems like a leap to me.
Right. That definitely would be a leap if that was all that we said about it, but there's also tied into that some, you know, other basic principles, like being against strong emergence, which you said that the emergence of consciousness would be, you know, a weakly emergent phenomenon. But I guess I would want to push back on that. And part of it has to do with what I was talking about in that episode you referenced with Aaron Rabinowitz on Embrace the Void, which is like an argument from vagueness about how consciousness can't be vague, which kind of forces you into a strong emergence position. What I would say is that if you think consciousness emerged weakly, then that would mean that consciousness would have to be vague. But because I characterize consciousness as, you know, in Thomas Nagel's famous definition that it's like something to be, there are no degrees of consciousness when it comes to Nagelian consciousness in that way. Like, it can't kind of be like something or sort of be like something. It's just the switch is on or off. It's like a binary. So there are no degrees, whereas all examples of weak emergence that people point out to me are examples where you have degrees of gradual emergence. Like, you have a smooth gradient of gradual change, but you can't have that with the emergence of consciousness. It's just going to be, boom, there's something. Now it's like something before it wasn't. And that just seems like strong emergence to me.
Right. Yeah, I can see why, for sure. As far as the vagueness argument goes, it would be a vague form of consciousness to say it's something that it's like to be an insect if we really try to think about it. And I just feel like that's increased exponentially if we apply it to an electron, because I think consciousness has a lot more to do with the body than just the brain. The whole nervous system, I think, is involved in our conscious experience. I mean, I think it has to be, and then it might be obvious saying that, I'm not sure. But I think it's more than just the brain, and to not have anything resembling a nervous system, I think that makes the claim that consciousness is vague, a little more reasonable.
But then you'd have to carve out some kind of middle ground between it not being like anything, you know, essentially non-mental existence, and, you know, some kind of halfway point between experience and non-experience.
Right. And, you know, that's something that I definitely need to learn more about, because I think there's a case to be, I mean, there might be a case to be made for that if we start thinking about, I mean, if we just think about how the eye has evolved and how there was some sensory apparatus that just detected light in the beginning, and you just kind of went, I mean, you didn't see anything, but you could detect light through it, or, and there was like a concave, I believe there's a type of fish that had like a concave. It didn't even have an eye, but that's kind of where the eye came out. But it just received signals through there. And I mean, that's probably a vague form of consciousness on my view. I mean, a really basic type, but I guess I'm just not convinced that it's one and the same. And I do think consciousness could be vague. I think there's a case that could be made for that.
Well, I definitely think that basically everything you could possibly mean by consciousness can be vague, except for one thing, like basically just experience. But everything else, so like obviously I'm not saying that like a fly has the same experience as a human or anything like that, but I think that people conflate consciousness with a lot of different things that can be vague, you know, like, you know, intelligence or language or even like thinking or something like that. And all, like, you know, the richness of visual experience, all the other things associated with consciousness that people talk about. Yeah, obviously those can come in degrees. Consciousness can come in degrees when it comes to basically every way that people use the word consciousness, except for one. But there's another reason, though, that panpsychists are, it's not just this anti-emergence argument. It's that, you know, panpsychism does solve a lot of problems, like it, specifically the dual aspect form that I'm talking about. But there's also this question of how we know that there is any essentially non-mental reality out there. And you find out that there isn't really any evidence for it, that the evidence for it is really bad. And then you're kind of just led to the burden is then shifted to try to justify the existence of non-experiential reality. Again, that's not like a knockdown argument, but there is a burden on non-panpsychists to say, why do you think there is such a thing as, you know, matter for which it's not like anything to be? And it really just comes down to an intuition that can't really be justified, that we really have no reason to trust. And if we reject that intuition, then it happens to, you know, get rid of the hard problem, eliminate the division between mind and body. You know, we can be thoroughgoing monists now, kind of make sense of mental causation if you're a dual aspect monist, without interaction and all that stuff. Like, there are so many benefits to taking on the view. It's just you kind of have to bite the bullet on this weird thing where it's like, well, it's kind of what you already knew, you know? Like, you're made of the same stuff as the table and the same stuff as all the other matter that's out there. It's just a radical form of monism is all. It doesn't mean that the couch is conscious in the same way that you're conscious or that everything is a subjective experience. But, yeah, I mean, I find it persuasive because it solves this one problem that we alluded to right at the beginning, you know, of like strong emergence, which I still think that someone like you would have to be committed to strong emergence. Like, I don't think that you can wriggle out of it by just saying, oh, it's just weak emergence. If you want to say that consciousness emerged, then you're going to have to say that it was strong emergence, which some people try to defend strong emergence. You know, like, I personally, I don't really get it. It seems to me that, like, if your position leads you to strong emergence, you should find another position, but some people try to defend it.
Right. You know, I definitely understand the appeal of panpsychism. There are many people far more intelligent than myself who are sympathetic to some version of it. But I just can't seem to be convinced by the arguments. It just seems really, I mean, and maybe strong emergence is not the answer. Trying to defend that, but I'm just not comfortable accepting. I mean, it just seems like a ad hoc extrapolation of mentality to everything. And I can't bite the bullet on it, I guess. At least not at this point, until, you know, maybe I'm exhausted from attempting to figure it out in this other manner.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, no one says it's intuitive. But once you kind of get the parsimony of it and the logic of it, and you're able to get over the initial weirdness of it, because it doesn't seem weird to me anymore. Now it just seems weird to me that people think it's weird.
Right.
Because it's like, well, I mean, you're a part of the physical world. Like, what, did you think you were separate from it? Like, you're conscious, aren't you? And I think that it's kind of funny. A lot of panpsychists are like strange bedfellows with illusionists in some way, because we both agree that if reality is essentially non-mental, it never would have emerged.
Right. Yeah. Maybe one day I'll get there. You know, a question that I wanted to ask you about the panpsychist view. So as far as the intrinsic nature problem goes, you know, phenomenal experience of mentality is the intrinsic nature of the fundamental world. So would it not be the case that if no physical properties could be identified as intrinsic alongside the mental, then mental would be more fundamental in the panpsychist view?
Well, hang on. I was thrown off by the inclusion of physical and mental there, because as a dual aspect monist, I think that there are no physical intrinsic properties. Like, there, what we call the physical are all extrinsic relational properties, and what we call mental are all, or not all of what we call mental, some of what we call mental are not actually intrinsic properties. But I think that, like, experience is the intrinsic nature of matter, but what we call matter, like what we call the physical, is actually the relational, extrinsic, behavioral, structural, etc. aspect of reality.
So then would that make, I mean, would the fundamental ontology of something like that be mental then?
Yeah, it would be both mental and physical. Like, that's the type of dual aspect monism that I subscribe to, which is that whatever we're made of, which you can call it, you know, like Sir Arthur Eddington called it mind stuff, the intrinsic nature of it is essentially mental in some sense, and the extrinsic nature of it is what we call the physical, like what physical science tells us about. This is just Russellian monism, basically. It's a radical form of Russellian. It's like Russellian panpsychism.
So by extrinsic, would that mean that it's not the essential nature?
I just mean not intrinsic. It's like, it's sort of a question of access. The observable aspect of reality is kind of what I'm calling it, extrinsic.
Okay.
I basically just mean not intrinsic, because I don't think intrinsic natures are observable from a third person perspective.
Okay. And by intrinsic, that you're just meaning the fundamental essential properties?
Yeah, or like the categorical grounding of these relational properties that we observe and that science tells us about.
Okay, I gotcha.
Which is not totally incompatible with what you've been saying about, at least about the more moderate. You could take like an epistemic form of structural realism and make it compatible with the Russellian panpsychism I've been describing, or dual aspect monism, or we're throwing a lot of jargon terms here. I hope we haven't completely lost everybody.
How would that fit? How would those two fit together on your view? If we're taking the epistemic structural realist position,
which two?
ESR and the Russellian monism.
maybe I have a funny understanding of ESR, and you can correct me, but I thought that ESR was basically saying that, you know, there's structure and there's relation, and that's all that we can know, like via science. But that is not necessarily all that there is. It's just all that we can know about the world, which I agree with. I don't think we have direct access to the intrinsic nature of anything besides the stuff that we're made of, because the intrinsic natures, the categorical grounding, et cetera, are like unobservable from a third person perspective, which I think that is useful because it makes sense of something that we know to be true, which is that A, experience is real. Some people dispute that, but experience is real, and that it's not observable from a third person point of view. Like, our experiences are not intersubjectively available. Like, there's this real thing, you know, consciousness, that you just can't know, like, through observation and, you know, collecting empirical data. So, you know, only people who, you only know about your own consciousness. So that's a very weird fact about our universe that, like, bothers me. And this is just the best way I've found to make sense of that.
Right, right. So, yeah, on that position, yeah, I think you understood ESR perfectly fine. So we wouldn't be able to know the intrinsic nature of anything other than ourself on that view.
Right. Right, because we're physical systems. It seems when people say, like, we can't know the intrinsic nature of anything, that strikes me as maybe in some of its more naive forms, like a almost like denial of naturalism, like that you're a part of the natural world, like almost like you're this like godlike observer sitting outside the universe, like looking at it. And it's like, no, you're a physical system.
Right, right. I think more radical positions of ESR would definitely say that. And that's definitely the position that Esfeld takes on his metaphysical relationist account. But, you know, I mean, and like I said before, I'm very sympathetic to Esfeld's views on that. But I don't think, I mean, if I make the claim that I can't know the intrinsic nature of anything, I don't think that beholds me to that type of God's eye view that you were just describing.
Right, right. Because I also subscribe to the view that you can't know the intrinsic nature of anything except what you have direct access to, which I'm claiming, which you would be skeptical of, that we have direct access to non-relational intrinsic properties via just, you know, like the view is just called revelation. I take it you reject revelation?
I take phenomenal experience seriously for sure. But I don't think they're non-relational because, I mean, what I would take by non-relational would be this idea that if they were non-relational, they would have to manifest themselves independently of anything else. Otherwise, that's one reason why I think experience is relational, because they're not only in the composition that makes up myself, but the natural world that I'm experiencing. I mean, there's a lot of relations going on inside me as an organism, and then how that relates to the world. And so it's kind of like a bundle of relations that is myself, and then the world, which is made up of a bunch of bundles of relations and structures. And I mean, and they're interacting. And I think that's why I think experience is relational.
Well, maybe I have an impoverished version or an impoverished idea of what relation is, because when I think of relation, I just think that if you tried to, because no one's denying that relation is important, like that it's obviously a part of our world, that you can't describe our world without talking about relation. But I feel like if you tried to describe everything about experience only using relation, you would leave out the essentially qualitative aspect of experience. Like, you could give a totally consistent relational account of what's going on in my brain and in my body, and you would capture everything, except you would just leave out the essentially qualitative what it's like of experience, which is why I think there has to be something in addition. Again, maybe I have an impoverished idea of what relation could entail, but that's why I am drawn to the idea that these relations need some kind of intrinsic ground.
Right, right. So, I mean, you know, on that view, you know, I think an argument could be made that it, you know, from like a panpsychist position, that it's both. Cause, I mean, because I don't think it would be tenable to say that it was that it's non-relational, but I think it would be there, a case could be made for it being as the panpsychist has it, but also making room for some type of relation.
Well, let me ask you this. This is kind of out of left field, but are you familiar with Hedda Hassel-Mørk?
I'm sorry. What was that?
It's a Norwegian philosopher, so she has a weird name. But Hedda Hassel-Mørk?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay, she's like she's a panpsychist philosopher. I think she's a Russellian panpsychist, and she has this idea called the phenomenal powers view, which gets at sort of why anything happens. And I'm curious as to what makes these relations go on your view? Like what are your views on causation? I know this is like a huge can of worms, but so there's only relation. And like I said, maybe I have a kind of like reductionist or impoverished view of relation. And that's why I can't imagine relation accounting for experience. But they do just seem different to me. I don't understand how to characterize qualitative experiences fully in relational language, but Merck's idea is just that experiences metaphysically necessitate their effects. You know, that's sort of why anything happens. Like that's sort of like the driver of causation. And she also subscribes to the view that experiences are like the intrinsic grounding, the intrinsic nature of the relations that we observe. But she's kind of sympathetic to Hume, where it's like, well, there doesn't seem to be any necessary connection between causes and their effects. And she's like, well, true, but when you look at it from the perspective of intrinsic natures, there is a necessary relationship because experiences necessitate their effects, which we have some direct experience with.
Right. So on that view, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just trying to make sure I've wrapped my mind around the idea. So some type of mentality or phenomenal experience is causing, and like, are you saying that that's the cause?
Yeah, it's like mental causation. Remember, she's a panpsychist, so she just extends mental causation that we apprehend firsthand just basically to everything. Like we are kind of being pushed around by our hedonically charged experiences, you know, like we do things because they're pleasurable or we avoid things because they'd be painful and so on.
Right, right.
So like there seems to be a necessary relationship between like pain and avoidance from our first person perspective.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't argue against that idea. I mean, obviously in my view, I wouldn't characterize it as mental. I'd characterize it as neutral. But I could see that from a relational perspective. I mean, there's this relation of things that are happening. It's this really complex relational event that's occurring that kind of leads to the behavior.
Oh, okay. So what are your views on causation exactly? Do you think you just take like a regularity view or something else?
It's kind of a regularity view. It's kind of complicated when, so let me get, it'll probably help if I talk a little bit about what the neutral monism stuff is on my view, because it's kind of tied into the Aristotelian conception of matter in a way. And Aristotle had a kind of a weird idea about change and process, which I don't ascribe to that completely, but I think it would help in answering this question. So on the relationist view that I was describing earlier, more so the relata, the stuff that stands in relation, being without intrinsic nature and being neutral and all that stuff, you know, one such implication that arises from that idea is that whatever stands in relation cannot be a substance because that implies some type of property or nature. If it isn't a substance, it cannot be of any particular form. And again, that's why I think Esfeld's idea of relata as physical objects doesn't make sense just by his prior argument. And so another problem that we run into here, and I'm always interested in trying to figure out what the problems are with my own views, and I try to follow them to the bitter end. And so another problem that we run into here is the idea that something without any substantive or formative existence of its own somehow instantiates relational entities and properties which evidently have some type of substantive or formative existence. And so that seems like a pretty big problem. And so I was led into, so I started thinking about the idea of potential. And from here, I was just led into the Aristotelian conception of prime matter. I don't use his version of prime matter necessarily, but I'm definitely sympathetic with some of the ideas of it. And so on this view, so prime matter is referred to as, quote, pure potentiality capable of taking on any form or properties without having any essential or intrinsic properties of its own, end quote. And so that sounds a lot like what I had been describing, and that was kind of Aristotle's view on it. And it's an indeterminate substratum that persists through change. So it's not formative or a substance in its own, and like I said, I even think it could be if it's neutral. But okay, and here's where we're going to get to the cause part, some cause part. So potential, in the Aristotelian sense, can be contrasted with actuality, something which exists in an actualized state, are manifest things of the observable world. So take a piece of wood, for example. The piece of wood is an actual entity. It's a substance, but it has the potential to be carved into a bowl, used to construct a table, or burned and reduced to ashes. And I mean, that just seems pretty common sense up until now, I think. But it doesn't seem right to claim that the potentiality of the wood exists in the same way as the actual piece of wood. But it also seems wrong to claim that potentiality is non-existent or it contains no ontological significance. So in a sense, potentiality and actuality for Aristotle describes a kind of process. And for Aristotle, there's like a really close relationship between potentiality and actuality. And actualities are what cause potentialities to come to gain an actual existence. And I know that's a lot of jargon and I'm sorry, but it's difficult to describe it in any other way. So something that exists in like a substantive form for Aristotle, something has to be actual in order to give rise or give actual existence to something potential.
Well, can we pause for a moment? Are you saying that this is compatible with structural realism as you've been describing it? Because it seems like at least the Ladyman type of SR like is trying to get rid of this sort of thing.
Okay, so I'm saying that it's compatible with a moderate version of structural realism, definitely not the Ladyman and Ross type. Ladyman and Ross type have no room for anything other than relations or structures, whereas the moderate type sees that as an issue because you can't have relations without something to be related or something standing in the relation. I mean, it doesn't make sense to take that position in my mind anyway. So it's definitely not compatible with the radical versions, but it is compatible with like Esfeld's more moderate view that admit that there has to be something to stand in relation.
Okay, I gotcha.
At this point, we have something without essential or intrinsic properties, something that is neither physical nor mental, but contains the potential necessary for actualization. Does that make sense?
Yes. Sorry, it's just the rain is really coming down over there.
I know. I'm trying to move, trying to find a better spot.
It's a little better than it was a minute ago.
This idea... And I just want to preface this with, I'm not going to make any of these moves that I'm about to describe, but I just want to tell you what this idea usually entails, like the prime matter idea. It usually entails an unmoved mover or something supernatural to get it going, because how can something not actualize itself? And so, I mean, we see this at play in our daily lives. Take the piece of wood example. When it's burned and reduced to ashes, something else actual, the fire, cause the potentiality to become actuality. And Edward Fazer, he's a contemporary philosopher. He's a Christian. He appeals to prime matter in a classical conception of God, like as a self-actual actualizer. But I don't think that this idea necessitates the need for God or an unmoved mover if we follow Esfeld, in the idea that, and it, so he places relations and objects that stand in relation on the same ontological footing. So there's an interdependence there. Like one can't really exist without the other one. So there's this ontological interdependence. And I think if you take Esfeld's view there and kind of place it into my position, we don't really have this, we don't have a need to get to, we don't have a need for an unmoved mover. And I would say that this doesn't seem like a strange idea if we appeal to the natural beginning of space and time as we know it. The details of the Big Bang aren't important to make the point. But if we take the general idea that somewhere, somehow, space and time as we know it emerged, and the world as we know it came into existence as a result, we could reasonably claim that the neutral potential and the actualized relations were birthed at one and the same time, thus providing a kind of grounding for the concurrent ontological primacy of both the neutral potential and the actualized relations.
Okay, and this is how you this you said this is not how you understand causation in terms of structural realism.
Not the strict Aristotelian sense, but in this sense, yes. Like I mean, I don't take the strict Aristotelian. I think his four causes are interesting, and I don't agree with all of them. But I do take this idea of potential and actualization seriously.
So you think there's a necessary connection between actuality and potentiality, and that kind of is how you make sense of causation, that there is a kind of necessary relationship between these two things?
Yes. Yeah, I would say there's definitely a necessary relationship there. And that's in, so because my neutral monism can't be a substance, I like to refer to it as neutral potential. So the neutral monism part of this relational account is the neutral potential. So the neutral potential is kind of instantiating the relations. But there's like a concurrent relationship there, because obviously something actual has to be the cause of some potential to come into existence.
Well, the unmoved mover is conspiring against us, so I think that we're going to wrap it up here. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on before we go?
I just wanted to make clear that I was not pausing an unmoved mover of any sort.
I know, yeah.
You know, and just to end, maybe with a quote from Heisenberg, Werner Heisenberg, because he actually saw the relation between quantum mechanics and the Aristotelian idea of potential. And there's actually quite a bit of work being done right now on how they're related, because there seems to be a lot of strange similarities between the two. The probability wave of Bohr, Kramer, Slater was a quantitative version of the old concept of potentia in Aristotelian philosophy. It introduced something standing in the middle between the idea of an event and the actual event. End quote. So on that view, the probability wave isn't just an abstract mathematical formula lacking ontological significance, but it also isn't an actual wave. It's potentiality. And so it's just interesting to me that Heisenberg and others, think about it in terms of potential. When the wave functions collapse, the potentiality is actualized. And we see the collapse when measurements occur. So something actual is actualizing the potential, and then somehow the particle now has definite properties. So there's, you can see it, the potential and actuality relationship in quantum mechanics pretty clearly.
Well, I will make a plug for you really quick. You have a Facebook page called Philosophy Daily, so I would encourage everyone to go like that. A lot of interesting stuff posted there. Is there anything else that you want to plug? Do you have a Twitter or Facebook or anything?
No, I'm good. I'm good there.
Well, Jacob Bell, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Emerson.